Okay, Tim, why don't you kick off?
Okay. Thanks, Hans. So the purpose of this meeting is to provide both boards with an update of the work of each board on their respective projects, with particular focus on disclosures, amortisation of goodwill compared to an impairment-only model, and simplification of the impairment test. And I think our intention is to have the boards discuss these three topics separately. So I'm going to give a brief overview of the ISB's research project and then talk through the disclosure topic from an ISB perspective. And then I'll hand over to Joy, who will do the same from an ISB perspective. So Agenda Paper 18A sets out a summary of the ISB's research project, which has been established in response to the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 and have been set a number of research questions which are included in paragraph 6 of Agenda Paper 18. The ISB made a number of tentative decisions in its board meeting last month, and the detailed board papers for that meeting are included as links in Agenda Paper 18A. And yesterday, the ISB confirmed that the next stage in the research project would be to publish a discussion paper, and the ISB instructed the staff to prepare that discussion paper for balloting. And based on the board's publication pipeline and workload, publication of that discussion paper should occur around the end of 2019. So if we take disclosure as our first topic, feedback from the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 highlighted that investors thought it is often hard to assess the subsequent performance of an acquisition. To provide users of financial statements with information on whether the key objectives of a business combination are being achieved, the ISB considered a management approach whereby the information on subsequent performance is based on how an entity's management monitors and measures in its own internal reporting whether the key objectives of the business combination are being achieved. And paragraph 15 of the paper highlights some of the concerns the ISB heard from stakeholders on this approach, and these will be explored further in the discussion paper. Other proposals to improve disclosure objectives and to make some targeted improvements to the existing disclosure requirements of IFRS 3 have also been considered by the ISB in response to feedback, and these will also be included in the discussion paper. More details of all the proposals considered can be found in Agenda Paper 18A for the ISB's June meeting, a link to which has been provided. So I'll now hand over to Joy to talk about the FASB's project.
Thanks, Tim. Can you guys hear us okay here?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Perfect.
Sounds good. Good afternoon, board members and fellow staff. I'll first provide a status of our project and then tee up the background on the disclosures on our end. My name is Joy Tsai, and many of us may be aware that there have been a series of updates that were issued subsequent to the post-implementation review of the business combination. Some of those updates included accounting alternatives to private companies and not-for-profits, while there are others that were options made available or requirements to all entities. At the FASB, we issued an invitation to comment in May, focusing primarily on public business entity views, but not necessarily excluding other entities from their feedback. One of the reasons why an IPC was issued was because of the extreme mixed feedback that we received among the preparer groups about the cost, as well as the mixed views among our user group about the information utility. We have not had many recent invitations to comment in the recent past, so it's worthy to point out that it is a staff document and that it does not carry any board member views. First, the document is meant to identify whether there is a cost-benefit issue that still exists after all the series of updates that have been issued, and whether or not standard setting is warranted for the system as a whole because of the optionality that is available today. The document also includes a broad range of approaches. One of the goals of the document is to be very balanced and not skewed in its views. We provided a 90-day comment period that ends in October 7th. I'll pause here to see if there are any questions so far related to the status of the project or the invitation to comment prior to moving on to the tee-up on disclosures.
Any questions? No.
Okay. Sounds good. And so in terms of the disclosure considerations, it is the important component that may allow us to bring information utility to our users. And so historically, we've heard that the description of the M&A transaction have been very useful to investment decisions. But we are hearing that impairment charges are, you know, similar to what you've heard, are too late, and perhaps the quantitative information is not quite reliable or verifiable. And so the most useful information potentially for our users is to know whether or not an impairment charge may be warranted, and not necessarily the precise amount of that impairment charge. So some examples that we initially considered were two. First is the early notification of facts and circumstances that led to impairment testing but did not lead to an actual charge. But we understand that SEC currently has guidance surrounding disclosures of unknown uncertainties that requires the reporting units to be disclosed that are at risk of failing step one. The second example that we were considering were the key performance assumptions and targets supporting an acquisition, some quantitative measures surrounding potentially like a cost synergies that they're expecting to target. But there are also SEC's MD&A guidance today that offers a liability protection for forward-looking statements under safe harbor provisions. So given those existing SEC guidance that we have today, the board may or may not potentially consider these particular disclosures. So the ITC currently has an open-ended question that asks whether there are changes that could be made given the current disclosure requirements that we have today. As an update, we have an initial user outreach that we did through our advisory group members, but we do plan on conducting further outreach with the user base as we approach the month of September. With that, I'll open it up to the board members for the discussions on disclosures.
Mary.
An experience I've had with some of the initial outreach on our potential disclosure, enhanced disclosures about an acquisition, is something that may be applicable for the FASB's consideration as well. And it comes to this, are we crossing over into forward-looking information territory? And one of the things, kind of the learning curve I went through was if you say disclose what you expect the performance to be, that starts feeling a lot like forward-looking information. But if what you're asking for is what were the assumptions that the company, you know, that management had when it determined the price of the acquisition, you know, it determined how much, it's more a disclosure of a what at that point in time were you assuming, so you're not making a forecast of the future. And I think, you know, when we come back to what was it that we were trying, you know, that we're trying to provide to users of financial statements, they wanted to know what the company's expectations were for this acquisition when they decided that X was a fair price, and then they want subsequent reports on what its actual performance was. So it's less an update of what are your forward-looking assumptions, but rather an actual versus what your expectation has been. And you know, I saw both when you shift the question, you know, what do you think of this, that people shift from thinking about it as forward-looking information to disclosures about assumptions. And these are discussions that I've had with groups of regulators and also in an update and discussion that I had with the IAASB, the audit standard setter, because they thought that in terms of auditability, while there were maybe some evidence concerns depending upon the size and the scale of the entity making the acquisition, you know, is it anything other than, internal representations, that getting information about what the assumption was at that point in time is something that should be auditable, as opposed to a number of complications that come when it's making updates to the forecasts of behavior, of performance.
Jung Woo.
Thank you. Following on Mary's comment on this disclosure issue, the first question is, do you think that disclosure, these kind of disclosure with some kind of forward-looking targets and some kind of actual results and their comparisons, So do you think that kind of non-disclosure is related to goodwill, as you've written here, or it's a kind of more related to general performance of a business combination? That's the one question. Another question is, SEC provides currently safe harbor provision on this forward-looking information. But if you require this kind of information, the note disclosure, we cannot provide the kind of a safe harbor provision. So you have to make be audited everything. So you analyze, you commented that risk in your paper, your ITC, very nicely. So just I'm concerning whether, even though you cannot provide that kind of a provision, you are going to still stick to that, require the entities to disclose this kind of information. That's their second one.
So, Jim Coker can help me out. I do believe that the safe harbor would not apply if it's in the audited financial statements. And so to the extent that disclosures are required by the FASB to be in the financial statements,
yes,
public comments would be audited, you wouldn't have it. Your point about is this disclosures related to evaluation of the business combination in its entirety or its goodwill, I do take Mary Tokar's point that the way you've described it does seem to be less forward-looking and more the ability to determine what was in management's mind at that time. But as far as I think that the reason investors were looking for this, correct me if I'm wrong, is because they want to be able to evaluate was the business combination as a whole an appropriate price and then hold them accountable for how they're managing the integration and managing that. So it's not, while it's about the Goodwill project, it's probably more about the business combination as a whole, but I don't.
Yeah, and I mean, and I looked at Tim about that too, but when we talk about it, I think people, they hear, what were your, what was the basis for the price? And they think, that what you're going to get is a prediction of future performance. The disclosure is going to be a prediction of future performance. But when you point them to the fact that you're trying to get to, how did you determine whether you're going to pay $100 million, $150 million, $175 million, and it might not be a, there are differing degrees of precision, but it's about what were the assumptions at the time. It might become forward-looking if you're required to update that performance expectation at each date. But if what you're asked to do is say, on July 1st, 2019, when you agreed the price of $175 million, what assumption did you have that, that underpinned that price? And then tell us what the actual performance of the entity or the group in which it is. It's the actual results rather than updated performance expectation. It steers you away from that forward-looking.
I should probably know this, but how long would you require that ongoing disclosure?
So, that's a very good question. And we asked that question, and there were a number of different views on that. The proposal at the moment that will be going into the discussion paper is for the year of acquisition and the two subsequent reporting years thereafter, so basically two years plus some. But there are different views on that. Generally speaking, there was more or less a consensus that this type of information has a fairly short life in terms of its usefulness, and therefore that's why that's the approach that's been taken. But there were other stakeholders that did comment that, well, in certain industries, in certain transactions, actually I don't know necessarily that a business combination has been a success until quite a long period of time, and therefore there may be the need for flexibility on that. And then to the question that you also just asked, I mean, I think in terms of why people want this information, again, there's a little bit of mixed views, but generally our user group said it was predominantly for stewardship purposes, and it's really to understand, it's not necessarily about this particular business combination, it's more about actually do I trust management with my capital in the future when they make future business combinations? So it's about how good management are at identifying targets, paying the right price, integrating. So that is definitely an aspect of what they want to know, is how integration is going. But I think, to Mary's point, that is always looking back at what were the original objectives set for the business combination and how are those objectives being achieved.
Jim.
Well, on your question about, is this about, are the disclosures about goodwill, at least as I thought about the ones we're talking about, to me it's no longer so much about goodwill, whether you had zero goodwill and then significant indefinite-lived intangibles, seemingly the disclosures would be equally applicable. So it must be about something other than, or at least partially something other than goodwill, which seemed like investment performance. You could draw the scope at business combinations. It opens up a lot of other questions in my mind about, well, what about investments that I make in advertising? I certainly made some original assumptions about why to run the advertising campaign, or an asset acquisition that fails the definition of a business combination. I had internal assumptions about, you know, future revenue growth or profitability or something. So would the disclosures be equally applicable outside of business combinations? R&D, not just the amount spent, but I certainly seemingly had some internal assumptions about why I spent money on the next generation technology. How did that pan out? Today, that rests in MD&A in the U.S., but that's the start down, bringing in a lot of investment return decisions, seemingly, into financials.
Nick?
Thank you. I mean, I think where we're trying to improve disclosures is not just about subsequent performance, but also around the details of the deal as it happens. It seems to me that, I mean, financial markets are always going to be ahead of financial reporting. Yeah. Investors are not looking to the impairment to see if this is a good deal or not. They need to think about this and analyse this in a more timely fashion. And so I think this has become more about business combinations, not just goodwill or intangible assets. And the things which we're proposing, including a quantitative assessment of the synergies rather than just a qualitative description, data that's often missing in our world, which is the value of the acquired debt, for instance. I know in the US a lot of transactions are done on a debt-free basis, so that may not be so relevant. The value of the pension liabilities that have been taken on board. And all that information helps an investor build that judgment around whether this, in their perspective, is a good deal or not. So I think there's some relatively easy wins before even getting into the issue of subsequent performance, I'd say.
Hal?
I think
Christine?
Yep. So I think in terms of the assumptions at the time, following on what Nick was saying, I think providing more quantitative information about the details is something that's doable and something that would be useful. I do question how useful the subsequent information is going to be, because I think you run into exactly the same problems there that you run into when you do impairment testing, and that is, to the extent that this new business or this acquired business is getting integrated, then you're going to have this masking effect, which we have the masking effect when it comes to impairment testing. And so I think it's going to be very hard to define what is actual performance for the business combination separate and apart from the performance of other aspects of the business that were there before or new or ongoing. I also wonder, given that, how it's going to be perceived by the market if you have a situation where an entity says, well, our subsequent performance does not it is different from what we expected, and yet when we run the impairment test, we don't have an impairment. I mean, how is that going to make the recognition and disclosure parts of this model appear to the markets? And I could see situations where that could well happen just because the way that the impairment test is run. And then last but not least, I think sticking to and trying to make the disclosures as quantitative as possible is really important, because as soon as we start going down the path of saying, well, you know, you can't come up with the numbers, so we're going to just require qualitative, it is quickly going to become very boilerplate. And one of the things that we are hearing from our users is, I want the quantitative disclosure. If all you're going to give me is qualitative and all that's going to become is boilerplate, then it's just noise that I have to get through in order to get to the bits of quantitative information I can get to. And so I don't want it if it's just going to be boilerplate. So those would be my
thoughts. Hal?
I want to go back to something Tim said. I think you got in your feedback, it was about trust and stewardship. And I wanted to push back a little bit on that. Trust and stewardship are all really nice things, but I think what investors are really looking for, and they may not be able to articulate this all the time, but it's really, did I get a return on that investment? That's not about trust or stewardship. It's about you paid X for whatever you acquired. Some of that stuff I account for in the balance sheet, and some of the stuff we don't account for. So we're talking about the stuff we don't account for. Quite often in those valuation models, that stuff we don't account for is the next year or two or three of earnings. And that's based on, I paid for existing customers, existing products. I know those existing customers and products paid me something back post-acquisition, but I have nothing that I'm pushing against that. There's no expense. It's like free income. And I think really what the heart of this is getting back to, what does goodwill represent? And we should know that because you came up with a price. There's a runoff of those existing customers and existing products, and that runoff tends to be pretty quick, particularly in this day and age. So I think there's a bigger issue here that we need to be really focusing on, and it's not trust and stewardship. It's at the, what are the underlying economics? How are those economics being reflected? And I think that gets to the heart of, you know, should goodwill be amortized or not? You know, and obviously I fall in the camp of it should be amortized because it's a very quickly declining asset. So I push back on, it's about the, I agree with Mary's comment earlier, this isn't forward-looking. This is about something I paid for, and I'm now watching that transaction unfold. Did I keep those customers? Did I keep those products? How quickly is that running off to get new products, new customers? Once I get into that mode, it's all on me as the steward, if you will, for that transaction. So I'd push back a little bit on some of those thoughts, and really I think we ought to focus more on what the underlying economics of these transactions are, which is something that should be known, and then gets to the point that you all made in your memo 18A, paragraph 30-C. This is, it's not possible to estimate the pattern in which goodwill diminishes and amortizes. I strongly disagree with that point. If you again get back to the economics of how that goodwill number comes about and what it really represents. So I know it's a little bit more of a speech than a question.
can I just make one just comment on that? Well, actually two comments. Just on the stewardship perspective, I mean, I guess the context of that question to our to the board's user consultative group was trying to understand why this information is needed, and one of the concerns is if it was needed for valuation purposes, for predictive value purposes, then there does become a question about why is that information specifically needed. It's a little bit like the comment earlier. For this particular type of transaction, a business combination, why are you not asking that information for just in your normal segmental type reporting, or for an asset acquisition or other aspects? And so it was to try to get a gauge of that.
Are you volunteering that information, or I'm happy to ask for that information in other cases too.
Well, I think that was to try to see whether it was appropriate to be asking for this information specifically for a business combination. And then on the second comment about goodwill, actually, so in terms of providing information on a quantitative basis and assessing what goodwill really is and what comprises goodwill, which was actually an avenue that the staff had started to look at in terms of some of the disclosure proposals. We got quite firm steer from, certainly from the preparer consultative group, that actually the focus shouldn't be necessarily on goodwill per se in isolation. It should be about the business combination, the transaction as a whole, because, you know, goodwill, as we know, is a residual, and therefore it was measured as a residual, and therefore becomes a little bit of a mixed bag of different elements.
I appreciate that argument, but I think the closer reality is that's a very short-lived asset in most cases. And I can appreciate the preparer's perspective. I get to recognize income in the future and not have any cost against it. That's a great, great deal. Unfortunately, you end up with these great debates about impairment, and Nick's point earlier about, you know, we're anticipating that the impaired asset, the fact that that asset is run off, you paid for customers that were existing 10 or 20 years ago and products from 10 or 20 years ago. That has nothing to do with today's income stream, yet we have the asset on our on the balance sheet because it failed the test. And you know, you and I have looked at this in the past. Once you get past kind of 5 years and you've got any amount of inflation in the economy, it's pretty hard to pass the impairment test. And as Shane's taught me, and if you're really good at accounting, you can always figure a way to keep passing the impairment test. Not that Shane ever did that.
But so you take that offline, Shane.
You end up with an asset that has no value, and you've never had any expense against the revenues in the early stages.
Gary.
Thank you. I just want to react to something Christine said about how do you measure subsequent performance, and I don't think that's going to make it into our DP, you know, that's down the line, but what I've been saying here is I think if there's ever going to be a case to have an objectives-based disclosure, this might be it, because depending on the company, if it's its own segment, you might say that's good enough. But depending on how a company is organized, assuming it's an individually big acquisition and not the routine smaller stuff, is you could perhaps disclose actual performance, you could disclose incremental contribution, you could compare against the acquisition assumptions, but they're all different measures of how well did it do. And I think the more synergies you're assuming, you know, with in an acquisition, the more it very quickly loses separate identity, because synergy is just a fancy word for I'm going to integrate it. And the bigger integration, the greater loss. So some of your, let's say you and I, our companies merge, we get another customer that neither one of us could get on our own, but together you can. Well, is that part of the base business that bought it, or is it part of, you know, the acquired company, or is it that's your synergy? Mm-hmm. You can debate this forever and ever, and there's not going to be an answer. I think the way to think about it is the management's view. Well, how does the CEO think of it? And he might think of it as incremental. Someone else might think an absolute. So I think if the idea is to give an idea of how well is an acquisition doing, it should be an objectives-based thing. I assure you, for most big companies, you've got a very material acquisition, and it might not be voluntarily disclosed, but in the earnings release backup material, there's a Q&A, how is this acquisition doing? And they've got an internal answer. But everyone around the table here, if you're in your own companies, might measure a little bit differently the same set of facts. But it is the internal view. So just give them a perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I take that perspective. I guess my response would be that if you can actually identify how the acquisition is doing, then you could more accurately calculate impairment. But what we know is that entities aren't able to accurately calculate that impairment, that we end up with the goodwill sitting there for 20 years because it gets mixed in with other factors like inflation, like other parts of the business that sort of masks potentially that the business combination wasn't doing what was expected.
As much as companies are dynamic and things move,
right,
and revenues and
exactly.
Cash flows and
yep.
assets all go in
yep.
different
and
directions.
Exactly.
Starting day two.
That's right. And so that comparison that you would do for impairment purposes is exactly the same comparison that's going to be in this disclosure. So my only point being that if we're saying that because that comparison isn't adequate to come up with an impairment amount, I'm concerned that comparison in a disclosure is no less informative. And in the one place where it might be more informative, you might end up with a situation where you have a footnote that says this thing didn't work out, and yet you still pass the impairment test, which is not going to look good for the organization.
Not working out means different things. I mean, it's still profitable. It's still throwing off cash flow. It's just not quite as rich, quite as early as you originally thought. Might only because discount rates have moved. Everything else is perfectly fine. I mean, all these things.
Oh yeah, no, I know.
It's come into play.
It's a total mess.
But the total, remember, the total of the reporting entity doesn't change. So if you make the acquisition look too rich, that has to come out of someplace. That comes out of the core business that bought it. Mm-hmm. There is a bit of checks and balances and truth and communication mm-hmm. in here, you know, because it is a zero-sum game against the consolidated results.
Right.
I just think if we almost us and we and you. To kind of step back and think of it in those contexts. There is no one answer. Mm-hmm. This is the objective is communication of its incremental contribution. Doesn't have to be, I think it'd just be profit, revenue, and cash is sufficient.
So is your proposal to quantify the synergies or just talk about the assumptions of the synergy? Would you actually quantify it? And what would you do if there was more than just a synergy and goodwill? Like in-place workforce, or if you were to remove customer relationships and make those not identified intangibles.
So in terms of synergies, yes, it is to quantify the synergies, or they expect. I mean, it may be a range because it might be difficult to come up with a point estimate,
okay,
but it may well be a range.
Okay.
Of expected synergies, if they were expected at the time of acquisition.
Okay, so I'm company A, I buy company B. In my calculation, I have an expected synergy of 1.1 to 1.8 billion. Okay. Shane audits me. Shane comes in, and is he verifying that was my calculation, or is he verifying that was my calculation and that was a good calculation?
Verifying that was, well, I,
that
I
was
would say
my calculation.
That was your calculation, that was your assumption.
Okay.
Gary?
You know, just thinking about this before I jump in, the synergies. You know, think about a company makes an acquisition. A lot of companies, you know, put in the synergies, either a dollar amount or a percentage of operating expenses. The market, in terms of stewardship, makes a determination relatively quickly. The company comes out, makes an acquisition, the market doesn't like it. Before the market even opens, the stock can be down 10%. So the market's making this evaluation. You as an investor get all your information from management presentations, almost nothing from US GAAP or IFRS. So basically you're starting at a point of, we provide little to no information to analysts about an acquisition. The footnote comes out 6 or 12 months after the deal. So essentially, the real issue becomes with disclosure, what happens if an acquisition has 5 or 6 reporting units? How do you possibly, first of all, analysts don't even know what a reporting unit is or a cash generating unit. Many of them have no idea what that means. They think it means an operating segment. So there's this disconnect between what we've done and how analysts view the world.
Sue?
And I think what Gary said is sort of consistent with what I was going to say. And I think that we're suffering a little bit with our project from its name. And actually yesterday at the board meeting we discussed the fact that the staff are going to propose potentially a new name for our discussion paper, because I think we're trying to get at exactly the point that Gary and Nick have both been talking about, which is we're trying to step away a little bit from the goodwill discussion, because I think some of the feedback I've certainly heard in investor meetings I've been to is that this whole goodwill construct is sort of an accounting thing that doesn't even really translate that well to discussions with investors, and where, although obviously the subsequent accounting for goodwill is a very important part of the project, we're also trying to think about what can we do to better equip the market with good information about acquisitions. Having said that, I think that Jim's point about why just business combinations, why not acquisitions that didn't meet the definition of a business combination, why not other types of major investment, I think that's a good question. but I think we keep coming back to is this information that's helpful from a goodwill perspective, but we're sort of trying to look at it a little bit more broadly than that, I think.
Neely?
I wanted to maybe build off of something, Christine, that you had said, and a couple of your comments just gave me pause, and Tim, if I mischaracterize this, please feel free to jump in, but if I understood correctly, you were saying that the disclosures don't necessarily provide more information than the impairment charge, or the potential disclosures potentially could. I think part of the way I'm thinking about it is that these disclosures will be providing the predictive information, in theory, that the impairment charge is not providing. So the impairment charge, I think we're kind of saying generally, is more confirmatory after the fact, but there's nothing in that period in between where maybe to the disclosures that the FASB has in the ITC or the staff has in the ITC, there's nothing in that interim period where either you haven't taken an impairment or you haven't done the impairment test and you haven't taken a charge, or you don't even need to take an impairment, or you don't even need to test for impairment because there's no indicator. So at least there's some information that kind of tells you over time you're going downhill, and then you can sort of predict that maybe there is a confirmatory impairment charge after the fact. And then the other thing I was thinking about is the optics of what if your things go downhill but there's no impairment charge. What does that mean to the market? And I think building on what Sue is saying, part of the problem is that this isn't really an impairment test of goodwill. It's an impairment test of a cash-generating unit that has goodwill allocated to it. And I think because we keep calling it a goodwill impairment test, there's this confusion about what we're trying to accomplish. So if we rename it or clarify what the objective is, then I'm wondering if that might alleviate some of the concerns.
Well, I think it alleviates some of the concerns, but my primary concern is that you're not going to be able to see the subsequent performance of the thing that you purchase, because there's all sorts of things that happen after that, things that you didn't predict, things that are related to other businesses that are part of this integrated unit now. And so just like the criticism of impairment is often too little too late, my concern here would be that these disclosures will ultimately end up being too little too late as well, that the market will be, as Gary's saying, far ahead of what's getting disclosed in the financial statements because of the inability to sort of carve out what the subsequent performance is relative to what the expectations were for that one business unit. I guess we can find out, right? I mean, you'll get the feedback. I just think it's going to be, I'm more in-house camp. I really view this as a wasting asset, or a wasting item. I wouldn't want to call it an asset, a wasting item. I just view these disclosures as a substitute for proper accounting on the financial statements, and I think they're going to suffer from many of the same problems that we run into with the impairment test because of the integration.
I was just going to say, and certainly we have had that feedback, mm-hmm. In terms of outreach that we've done to consultancy groups and other stakeholders, that integration can be a barrier here. And we did explore it. We had a meeting of our joint preparers and user groups, and we did explore that issue. To an extent, this is a little bit the focus of this proposal is about sort of a management approach, and it's looking at, well, how does management actually assess whether a business combination has been a success or not? It could be interesting to an investor if management turns around and says, well, I don't actually really know because it's integrated, and I don't actually really know whether it's doing what I thought it was expecting to be done. So I think we've put the focus on the sort of management approach to because in that circumstance where integration was expected, I think our thought, or the staff's thought, was, and this is definitely what we're going to try to explore in the discussion paper, was that, well, management would maybe use combined targets in order to do that assessment. And yes, there may be some noise because actually some of the performance is the existing business maybe performing very well or not performing very well. But it's acceptable noise, and that's what we're trying to explore, whether it is acceptable noise and whether combined in those circumstances, whether combined measures would still be useful. But it, I mean, it's definitely feedback that we have had, and it's something that needs to be explored in the discussion paper.
Mary?
Well, I think this is further to what Tim is saying, and he may need to correct me if I've misunderstood, because he spent a lot more time thinking about this. But presumably, if you make an acquisition, and then after you acquire it, you integrate it with your existing operations, that's not a surprise to you that you integrated it, because you presumably would have had this plan for how you are going to use the acquisition. So if you go back to what were your assumptions, what were your expectations, whether they're synergies, cost savings, et cetera, maybe the original disclosures are on the combined business. And presumably, if you understand the risks, the uncertainties, you might allow for the uncertainty of some of the noise or the good luck that might happen, et cetera. And these are all things that you would factor in, maybe in a very disciplined fashion, maybe in a very kind of instinctive fashion when you're setting the price. So I think it does come back to this idea of what were the factors you considered when you determined that you'd pay X, and maybe you're willing to pay somewhere between X plus and minus 10%. What were the factors that you considered? And if what happens is we didn't intend to integrate it, but as we got our hands around the business and our plans shifted or whatever, we decided we did have to integrate it, that again is information to the market about it isn't working as we expected. How are we responding to actual being different from expectation? And what actions are we taking? It is information about the post-acquisition performance. So is it the ultimate answer that cures all the problems? No, but I think I understand your focus on the shielding effect in the mechanical calculations of impairment, and I can see why you'd be concerned that they'd also carry over to anything that is a disclosure about post-acquisition performance. But I think we are trying to step back and say, how do you give information about how this is performing and not just qualitative, information? And I'm sure there is a trust element about it, but I think it is more just a straightforward, you decided that it was worth making this investment. How is it performing so we can assess return?
So I guess, there's a number of ways. It comes down to holding management's feet to the fire, right?
Or to account.
Right. And that's what I mean. Yeah. Okay. And so there's a number of...
Too hot to do fire today.
Right. But there's a number of different ways of doing that. I think one way is to say that when the company has to take an impairment when it becomes clear that the organization, that the business combination is, the acquired business is not performing the way that it was anticipated. So impairment is a way of holding management's feet to the fire. This disclosure I view as a way of holding management's feet to the fire. And amortization of the goodwill itself is a way of holding management's feet to the fire over time. Okay, so there's different ways of doing it. My concern is that both with the impairment test and with this disclosure, there's a ton of judgment that's going to be brought to bear. You're not going to have a management that's going to want to stand up and say, I made this acquisition and, oh, by the way, it's falling apart. So there's all sorts of things that they're going to be able to do because of the subsequent performance is not observable on a standalone basis most of the time. So that's all I'm saying is that just as there's all sorts of difficulty in the impairment model, those same sorts of difficulties are potentially going to show up in this disclosure, and you might see that it's still too little too late and management's feet are not being held to the fire.
But I don't think it has to be observable on a standalone basis if you went into it thinking that this is not going to be run on the stand. So Right,
but even if you
the benchmarks
even,
you
even if you
consider.
Have those benchmarks, maybe you know that the piece of the business that was the existing business, so you went into a joint, but the piece of the business that was already the existing business ends up with some sort of wild windfall, again, that makes it look like this combined business is doing great, when in fact, relative to what you had anticipated when you made the combination, what you paid for it, that piece isn't the piece. So there's all sorts of stuff that's going on. It's you know, it's nice to think that we can see the piece that relates to what we originally planned, but my point is that is almost always going to be unobservable.
But in the context of an impairment only, I know your view is amortization, but in the context of an impairment only, do you think the disclosure would add value?
I think it's going to run into the same problems that the impairment test runs into.
The answer is no.
Even if it is describing the value of this synergy at the date of the business combination?
Well, no, what I said was at the date of the business combination, all of that information that is, you know, at this point in time when we're doing the BizCom, it's the subsequent comparison to determine whether or not the ongoing amount, value that's sitting on the balance sheet is justifiable or not. It's all the subsequent accounting and subsequent disclosure that I have concerns about, not at the point in time when the BizCom happens.
Yes, can I just go back to your question that you asked him earlier? Is it that the synergy that the company told me, $1 billion, is the calculation that they came up with? Or is it that they actually achieved that in subsequent periods? I'm not certain. I thought Tim said it was just to confirm that the $1 billion, you have some support for that $1 billion.
So that's on day one, but it would also, assuming that's a key objective of the business combination,
so it wouldn't matter how
it would be subsequent performance as well.
It wouldn't matter how Russ calculates that $1 billion. It would say Russ's calculation under Russ's standard, whatever that may be, is $1 billion. And he may have included cost savings, he may have included revenue enhancements, he may have included a wide range of things, or he could have taken a very narrow definition. Doesn't matter. His $1 billion and Marsh's $1 billion could be very, very different in terms of content, as long as it's how they looked at it, and that could be on a transaction-by-transaction basis, because there's no standard to compare it to. I'm not certain how that would be very helpful. Because management's already telling me what the cost savings are going to be. They give me some sense of it includes revenue enhancements or not. So they've already told me that, and you're just telling me, the investor, that what Russ just told me is what he just told me. I'm not certain how that helps me.
I guess it's assuming that was an assumption for your acquisition price when you went into a business combination, and a number of different entities had that assumption. It's making sure that all of those entities provide that information for all what is deemed to be material business combinations.
So, and I guess when I'm
it's mandating that, as opposed to
I'm going to get that much more information.
So we're not talking about Russ coming up with his estimate of a billion. And then next year you say, do we still expect the billion or not? What we're saying is, when you do the transaction, management figures out how it's going to monitor the achievement of that. And that might be, but if it's cost savings, it might be what are the actual cost savings. If it's revenue, it might be what's revenue. In some cases, it might be more qualitative than that. The management will then have its feet held to the fire by having identified how it's going to monitor the performance in achieving that. And then you'll report against that.
Just one suggestion for you. Maybe I'm a little sensitive to this issue because I lived through a massive consolidation in the banking industry in the U.S., and every quarter we went through dozens of these transactions. So I get to see a wide range of companies constantly telling me, quote, the same information, and the inconsistencies were, you know, they were significant, but over time certain kind of metrics developed. So you may want to look at just the U.S. consolidation of the banking industry going from the early 90s all the way through 2006 or 7 and pull those types of transactions out. One of the things that you'll see and read about is once you get past the first quarter, depending on the size of the transaction, it was quite often very rapidly subsumed into the business. It didn't take long to change the branch name, to put in a couple new products, and the system within, you know, 2 to 5 quarters was pretty much gone. Whatever was there before, and all you were left with were the customers. And you weren't even left with all those. You were typically left with, if you kept 80%, you were doing pretty well. So 2 years may be optimistic in terms of...
Nick.
Thank you. So I spent just over 30 years as a buy-side equity investor.
Then you're 25 years at Hell, so...
And I think I spend an awful lot of time looking at M&A transactions. You know, these are very significant investments. The returns are highly variable. They can change the course of a business. And so I'm very interested in, not just from a stewardship perspective, but from a decision useful, you know, am I going to get a decent return on the capital? And particularly when they do the next transaction and the transaction after that. So this is incredibly powerful information for me, and thinking about this is very important. And through that time, I've seen goodwill written off, I've seen it amortized, and I've seen it subject to an impairment test. So I've had just about every flavor you could have over my career. And I can honestly say amortization does not help me hold management's feet to the fire, personally. In my practical experience, it doesn't help me. I'm there looking at cash return on cash invested, as many companies would be looking at in terms of when they do that transaction. So I'm interested in exploring the subsequent performance issue further, because I think it gives me better insights, better leverage in terms of holding management's feet to fire.
Anne?
I also want to pick up on Hal and Christine's points, following on from Nick. I think it's worth reflecting on why we're in this space about the subsequent performance. And we have talked about it's got two aspects in it. It's about what's at acquisition, what management was expecting, and then this problem of reporting on what happens subsequently, because we have been told that often you can't track it, it disappears. But the reason, I think if we reflect on why we got to this place, it was because we saw inadequacies around impairment, which you're recognising, and also around amortisation. And Nick has just given his view that, as an analyst, he couldn't see amortisation holding the feet to the fire. We recognising problems with impairment tests, so that's not doing it. So we're struggling to find something that will do it. And I think it's... difficult for us as standard setters to say that we have no tools, and so hence why we keep persisting. So I take on board what you're saying about these disclosures, and we already know that there'll be people that won't like, there are people in the communities that won't like them, and they'll present all the problems with them. But we're really scratching our head to try and find what we can do when we find ourselves with so many deficiencies in the impairment test, so many issues around amortisation, and so we've come up with this third thing that we're looking at because of that, and you know, none of us is going to go away from this meeting this afternoon encouraged.
I was just going to say that a few people have talked about holding management's feet to the fire, and I think that's perhaps one aspect of it, but for me it's a much more, I think we're just trying to think of ideas to try and meet an information need we've heard about when we've been talking to investors who have told us that they don't really think about goodwill the way we think about goodwill, with these weird cash generation units that we come up with and the way that we calculate it. They don't really focus that much, I don't think, on the subsequent accounting for goodwill, no matter how we do it. But they really want to better understand business combinations, and this is just a way to try and equip them with more useful information. And I agree there's going to be lots of judgment, and I'm sure we're going to hear that it's too hard to do. But I think we want to at least test the idea and see which bits of it we can get to work. And certainly for me, whether I was in the amortisation camp or the impairment camp, I think this is a separate issue. I think no matter what we did with the subsequent accounting for goodwill, we think that this is worth exploring because of this information need we've been hearing about from investors. And I think that's why, as a board, there's at least majority support, I can't remember how many, for the disclosure package, even though we were very divided on the view on the subsequent accounting for goodwill. So I don't see it as an either-or from my perspective either.
So, I appreciate the argument. Does that tell you that I've got to come back and make sure Russ's way of coming up with that $1 billion is, I have to completely understand as an auditor, and then I have to be able to apply that quarter after quarter. And my guess is Russ isn't going to have a great set of, you know, codification rules writing down how he came up with that $1 billion. It's going to be, we kind of did this and we kind of did that, and it's on the back of an envelope. I'm sure it's on spreadsheets. But it's, you know, it's going to be a, you know, logical, thought-out process, but mapping that against the accounting systems and being able to put internal controls around that, report and audit on it, I'm just wondering how you can actually do that. I would love it as an investor. I think that would be fabulous information. I just question whether it's doable or not.
Well,
it's operable.
Nick's probably better equipped to answer that than me. In the discussions I've had with investors, and I've had far fewer than you guys have, but I think part of it is they just want to understand what's behind the amount that management decided to pay. And I'm not sure they necessarily need it to even be that scientific, but at least give me a few more clues than what I've got now.
Well, that was kind of the thought process by amortizing it, the goodwill, is that, you know, you knew it was part of the calculation, it was embedded in all that calculation, and there are probably, at least in my experiences, there were always models and earnings behind that number, and I knew what that runoff was. And if I amortized against that, that was in effect, a proxy for, here's what management thought it was, and here's what happened. At least that's what was planned to happen. If it needs to happen a little earlier, that you've got an impairment that lasts a little longer, we probably are not going to change the amortization period, and you're done. So you get some decent information, similar but in a different way.
But you're bringing it back to goodwill accounting again. And I'm not sure that most investors are so into the goodwill accounting. I think their first question is, why the hell did you pay that much?
Well, that quite often, that's what I whispered to Daryl. It's usually, why did you pay that much? Are you kidding? You paid that much? That quite often is the discretion. But at least then you have some understanding that, forget about the word goodwill, whatever that residual is between what you paid and the stuff you account for, okay, that difference has some runoff to it in your assumptions, in what you did to come up with that purchase, to justify the price to the board and to the public, to the markets, then you're just going to run that off over that same time period.
Martin?
Yeah, same as Sue, and from the beginning of this project, man, for me it was clear that neither the payment-only approach nor the amortization could give good information, is the acquisition successful, yes or no. And that, I think we decided we need a kind of better information through disclosure. Is that really kind of what we need? And therefore, I think we're proposing now this kind of new disclosure. And is it practical? I mean, we have tested it with at least our global preparer forum, and they were thinking they can do it. And even in the integration phase, then the assumptions which they used is an integrated number, and which they're tracking for a number which is also integrated business. So I think we should not mixing up really kind of subsequent account of goodwill and better information about is the acquisition successful, yes or no. I think there are two different issues.
I think, Tim, you have to move on.
Well, yes. Yeah, we have actually gone a little bit into the amortization impairment only debate.
Because
Joy was actually going to tee that bit up first. I don't know whether you want to quickly do that, Joy.
Yeah, Joy, yeah. Go ahead.
Sure. Let's do that. Just for some background, some of us may remember that back in 2015, the board decided to separate this project on subsequent accounting for goodwill into two phases. Phase one simplified the goodwill impairment test by removing the step two of the impairment test. Today, we are in phase two of that project, which is to consider whether to make additional changes to goodwill, considering whether to permit or even require goodwill amortization or further changing the impairment testing methodology. Some of us might wonder that why we're considering it for public business entities now. And if we were to go back a few years, the PIR of 141R really noted that the cost-benefit issue was pervasive among the smaller entities. Therefore, those private company alternatives that we have today were developed and have since been widely adopted. However, as you may know from our ITC, the feedback from among our preparers have been mixed. For example, some preparers don't incur that much cost, what we found out, and then others explained that they would actually continue to perform this type of analysis even if it was not required by GAAP, and that's the goodwill impairment that I'm talking about. I'm not going to get into the mixed user views because we heard a lot of that discussion just before. But just as a reminder, the objective of our project here is to really rebalance and understand the cost-benefit issues after hearing these mixed feedback. So with that, I'll pause and allow the Tim to further, if there's any tea up there on your end.
Yeah, it's very quick. But from the ISB's perspective, having found it not possible to make significant improvements to the impairment test nor to design an impairment test that would target the acquired goodwill, and given the feedback from the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 that goodwill impairment losses are often not recognised on a timely basis, the reintroduction of amortisation was being considered by the ISB for the reasons outlined in paragraph 27 of Agenda Paper 18A. The question the ISB considered was whether the findings of the research project had provided compelling evidence that amortisation should be reintroduced, rather than whether amortisation of goodwill was preferable to an impairment-only approach. And the arguments are summarised in paragraphs 29 and 30 of Agenda Paper 18A, and are considered in more detail in Agenda Paper 18B for the ISB's June meeting. A small majority of the ISB tentatively decided to retain the impairment-only model, but both sets of arguments will be presented in the discussion paper, and stakeholders will be asked whether they can provide further evidence to help the ISB find a more conclusive answer to this question. So I'd like to open it up now to the board to discuss.
I'd be interested in comments from FASB board members or staff about how you're thinking about how to get information to help with the decision making. Because I was really interested in reading your ITC that there were so many of the same issues raised that we have raised, and you also mentioned that you're interested in new information, which is in our papers, and also not necessarily people presenting their theoretical position and arguing off a theoretical position. And I just wondered if you've had any discussions yet on how to progress this, because we do know there are entrenched views, and there is a danger that we're just going to hear it all over again for the entrenched views. So I'm just wondering if you had any thinking yet about how to actually move this to a point where we can make good decisions.
Very good question.
I'll start. I think, first of all, I think we have to decide, is the problem of goodwill that it is cost prohibitive at this point to get it off the balance sheet? Or is the problem with goodwill, is it not giving sufficient information about the future business combination's performance? So I think some would say, myself included, is that it ought to come off the balance sheet. In other words, we're trying to make sure the assets are not overstated. In that case, what's the cheapest way to do it? I personally think what the board has historically done to remove step two is a really big step and can reduce cost. Other board members say, I agree with the objective of that, but I think amortization is a much easier way to make sure the assets are not overstated. I sense that what Hal and Christine are saying is they'd like to use amortization as a way to help hold management accountable for the ongoing performance. And so we first have to decide, no?
I'm not there to hold a bat over management. I hold a bat over management through buying and selling stock, right? This is, you did a transaction, right? I want to see how you performed against that transaction.
This is the same thing. I mean,
I view that as
it's
different.
How you're assessing the performance of the business combination.
Yes.
To hold management accountable to see if they did a good business combination. But I don't mean to belabor the whole management.
Did I get the return on the investment that I thought I was getting?
Yeah. So I don't think we've established the objective to make sure the balance sheet's not overstated, or is the objective to really provide better information about the performance of the business combination, or if it's both? And we have to do that, and then I think the follow-on decision may flow from there.
And Ann, to your point, I think we're going to keep going in a circle until we get some agreement or at least feedback from all the stakeholders in terms of which camps they fall in. What do they view as the economics of the transaction? I mean, I hold a particular view that you're paying for typically 2 or 3 years' worth of earnings. That's what is embedded in that goodwill number, at least the predominant part of that is the next 2 to 3 years. And that disappears very quickly. That would lead you to amortizing in some runoff consistent with the earnings pattern.
3 years?
Next two to three years, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And once you pass that, into, you know, the reason you've got your disclosure set up is that once you pass kind of that 2 to 3 year time period, then it's just part of the ongoing entity, so you can't really hold it separate and distinct from that. And I think there's a lot of logic there. I think if you were going down a disclosure path, I wouldn't go much past the 2 years. I'm not even certain you can get to 2 years. I'd be making thinking 2 to 6 quarters of information, and after that, it disappears.
So then, currently, the most outrageous decisions are being made because many acquisitions are 20, 25 times yearly earnings. To write that off in 3 years, I mean, that is... So it's all very bad business.
We can debate company by company, transaction by transaction, but I think when you look at the bulk of what you're acquiring is existing customers and existing products, and the turnover of customers and the turnover of products, most of that is relatively short-lived.
Well, that shouldn't
just... Yeah, but that's even for an existing company with that acquisition, so it always turn out to an over...
That's just market prices. Ignore a business combination. Market caps are 20 times earnings.
Yeah.
So you're saying that, I guess, the market is completely mispricing.
Well, that's...
Yeah.
I mean, the business combination is just accumulation of the market price.
Mary.
I'm going to repeat a plea I made yesterday when we were talking about the ISB discussion. I'm not sure if you guys are in the same place or a different place on this point. The DP that we're putting out, I think it's important for our consultation that we say we're asking questions that we've looked at before, not with a clean sheet of paper, if you were doing it all over again, what decision would you reach, but rather given both the PIR but also the subsequent exploration we've done, do we have evidence that says it's necessary to change the subsequent accounting for goodwill, as opposed to, let's start this all over again, what decision would you make if you were doing the standard-setting project for the first time? And I think that's going to be an important messaging point for us. Now, it's a bit different because you've issued a staff document rather than the board taking a view in preliminary views, but I just wanted to highlight that as something that, at least personally, I hope I'll see as a tone in our DP, to bring an end to this eternal discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. Marcia.
Yeah, I just want to respond to Anne's comment about will we hear the same thing we've heard before. To some extent, yes, but I think that there have been more conversations with users about this topic than there really have been preparers. Preparers have been engaged in conversations about the impairment test, but this to me is a slightly different process that the FASB is going through, because we're actually now asking and seeking input, how do you feel about amortization? That hasn't been on our radar screen as an option for public companies. So I think that may be interesting.
Sue Cosper.
So I think it's interesting, just thinking about your comments, Mary, because, you know, we've been certainly working on this topic for a number of years. You know, pick your stakeholder group, you know, starting off with private companies, then not-for-profits. And so we're somewhat fractured, right, in the U.S. in the way we're thinking about it, and certainly the objective has been cost and complexity. And so I think, at least the way I viewed this project, was really about, first of all, did we get that cost equation correct? And, you know, if we were to extend it to public companies, would we do something different? And should we think about extending that difference to the system as a whole? And so I think some of the discussion points are quite interesting on the disclosures, but certainly that has not been our primary objective here to date. Maybe it will, you know, pending some of the feedback we get on the ITC. But, you know, certainly because we have made decisions and we have this sort of fractured accounting in the U.S. I think, you know, there's a different hurdle to overcome.
You mean the difference between private companies and public?
Right, so we have, right, private companies, and we just extended it to not-for-profits as well, and I know that's beyond your scope, but...
No, but we have also, we have amortization in IFRS for SMEs, but only as a simplification of full IFRS. We would not think about taking IFRS for SMEs as the starting point. Is that something that we should extend to full IFRS, knowing that the amortization decision for SMEs was just a matter of simplification? Of course, you could say, well, we've come to the conclusion there's no other way to get rid of goodwill, if that's what you want. For that reason, you might choose to reintroduce for amortization, but it's not as if we in itself, the fracture between SMEs and public companies is no issue for us. Christine?
I had a question for Tim, just helping me to understand the current guidance for international accounting standards. So it seems, when I was reading through this, that the first, it's a one-step impairment test. So you go through at the cash-generating unit level, you do a comparison of the carrying amount to the recoverable amount for the cash generating unit, and then you allocate first all of that impairment to goodwill down to zero, and then if there's still some amount left over, then you allocate it to the remaining assets on a relative carrying amount basis or relative fair value, anyway, some basis. So my point is, and it's always been that way, right? I mean, that's not a new thing. So in other words, did you have a step two and got rid of it, or did you never have a step two? Okay. So that's why I'm not convinced, Russ, that getting rid of step two is going to be that much of a cost savings, because ISB has never had a step two, and yet these concerns about cost still arise. On the flip side, we have a step zero, which is the qualitative assessment, which I think you're thinking about potentially. And on the flip side, we've had that qualitative assessment for a while, and we haven't heard that it's been the silver bullet either. So I think there is something for each of us to learn from the existing models, that neither step zero nor step two, getting rid of or adding those things, seem to have addressed the underlying concern of the cost of the impairment.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the step zero, What the board's considering is removing the annual requirement to do a quantitative test and going to a trigger-based test. So it would be different to a step zero, but on the basis of a cost and complexity type.
Right.
And actually, you know, I think in terms of feedback that we've had so far on that, there is some mixed views about exactly what the extent of the cost saving would be in doing that, and that's partly what will be being explored in the discussion paper from stakeholders, is it really a big cost saving and a consideration of that.
Right, and at the risk of potentially further delaying the impairment charge, because there is some rigor around that process of having to do it annually versus having a system that's going to pick up on the trigger in a timely fashion and then having the rigor around the assessment of the trigger.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that's the other aspect that's been explored in a discussion paper, is the impact on the robustness of the test of not performing it as frequently as a mandatory annual test would be, and exactly how much impact would that have. Because in the staff's paper in June, it doesn't seem, by doing the test more frequently or as frequently as done at the moment, you know, gets over the issues that we have today, and therefore maybe actually the impact on the robustness of removing that requirement to perform it every year, it might not be as great as expected, but that's what's going to be explored in the discussion paper.
Gary?
Yeah, just there's three reasons why I don't support goodwill amortization. I mean, the first, the majority of investors and I don't believe it provides decision useful information. Second, if you put together an arbitrary 10-year period for the amortization, every deal is going to be amortized over 10 years. So Hal doesn't get the information he wants, because if you had five acquisitions over a five-year period and four of them said 10-year period, then the fifth said 5 years, you'd be implying the fifth acquisition wasn't that great. And I think if you believe that goodwill impairments are infrequent today, if you introduce goodwill amortization, you'll probably never, almost never, have a goodwill impairment. So I understand the reasons why you'd want to do it, but I just don't think it's just going to lead to a lot more non-GAAP adjustments that provide little to no information content.
Mary?
I want to pick up on Christine's comment, characterization of there's no silver bullet, and, you know, there's no magic solution, or will we find one? And I think that's maybe partly how our expectations have changed. You know, there was some excitement that maybe the headroom approach was, you know, the silver bullet we'd been looking for. And maybe we have to reset our expectations. You know, Tim talked about the possibility of relief from the annual impairment. And, you know, having to weigh that, you know, what do we expect the impact would be on timeliness? If what we've heard is most of the challenge with timeliness is actually timeliness in adjusting management's expectations that are reflected in the cash flow, not, you know, in the frequency of doing the test doesn't really impact that, then maybe there's a cost savings. So I think what I'm coming back to is that there may not be the answer that unlocks this, and so part of what we're exploring in a discussion paper that's more than just goodwill. And by the way, I think what the staff said is we had to come up not just with a new title, but an exciting one as well, that it may be a package of tuning that is pretty on the whole, not something you can say, look at what the great thing is that we just do, but you rebalance you get some cost savings, some improvement in information, and on the whole end up in a better place if you can manage the change so the change itself isn't a high cost. I think we've all worked on it long enough that you know, there are no more rocks to turn over to see if there's, you know, the magic solution that's a single thing we can do. So I don't think we're thinking anything is the silver bullet.
Okay.
And I think Joy is going to take this one.
Yeah. So just before, I just wanted to add on to, you know, Anne's comment and Mary's about rehashing any of the new stuff. I think on our end, even though, right, there is no silver bullet, what we have done differently a little bit is when we talk to our users and have them understand the cost behind preparing the impairment test, some of them have actually said, well, if that's really the case, they're okay with just removing the goodwill impairment test and going with amortization. To the point of what Nick's mentioned before, that there may be no information to be put forth for a goodwill amortization. They're at least okay with it, knowing the cost that's truly involved with the analysis. Okay, so teeing up the qualitative test. So the FASB introduced a qualitative screen in 2011, and it's optional for all entities today. And although during initial adoption, we did learn that there's extensive documentation, subjective judgments, and uncertainty for auditors' requirements, there was increased cost in the beginning. But we, after some familiarity with it, the adoption rate has historically been about 50% or more from a 2017 survey that we have, both in the public and the private sector. We understand that firms who utilize the optional qualitative assessment have been those that have a lower impairment risk and also a higher cost of performing the quantitative test. In that same survey, it's been noted that approximately 30%, though, preferred step one over step zero. And we have not heard any specific recommendations from stakeholders in terms of how to improve this qualitative test, but our ITC does include a broad question asking whether or not there is anything that the board could consider to improve it at this time. We'll see what we hear back by October 7th, but I'll pause here to turn it over to Tim.
Thanks, Joy. So during the post-implementation review of IFRS 3, many stakeholders commented that the impairment test was costly and complex. In its July 2018 board meeting, the ISB decided, in view of the main challenges identified by the stakeholders, to explore whether to provide relief from the mandatory annual quantitative impairment test, whether to remove the requirement to exclude cash flows from a future restructuring or future enhancement in estimating value in use, and whether to permit the use of post-tax inputs and discount rates in the estimation of value in use. And in its meeting last month, the ISB reached a preliminary view that it should develop these proposals. This is summarised in paragraphs 35 to 42 in Agenda Paper 18A, and more details are provided in Agenda Papers 18D, E and F for the ISB's June meeting. So again, I'd like to open the discussion up for both boards now, and I guess if there are, that's the extent of our tee-ups, if there are any other questions on any other aspects of the board's respective projects, this will be the opportunity to ask those as well.
Have we exhausted ourselves? I mean, Nick is not done yet.
And you know what I'm going to ask about, don't you? I'm just intrigued in learning a little bit more in terms of why you're exploring around those other intangible assets that are only recognised on acquisition. What's taking you in this direction? And where, whether it's too early to think where you may land up on this, but I'm just intrigued on the background.
I think he's a big fan of recognising intangible assets more broadly.
Go ahead,
Jim. The question's for us. On
Some of us are interested in looking at that question because we don't think they meet the definition of assets. For example, non-contractual customer relationships that you don't control are recognized separately from goodwill in a business combination. I don't think they meet the definition of an asset in the framework. And so I think it's useful to consider whether we should continue to recognize assets that don't meet that definition.
This is music to the next ears.
So I'd suggest this is perfect area to find cost savings for me, because I don't think it helps any of us, and I think it does cost to do it.
Gary?
Yeah, echoing Jim's point, the disclosure for the footnote disclosure that says customer list and non-compete agreements, I've never heard anybody reference that footnote disclosure. I mean, what does a customer list mean? You calculate a number that basically has no value to an analyst. It's just there in a footnote, and it's irrelevant.
So when we develop the alternatives for the private companies, and our private companies are much broader than just your SMEs, that was one of the areas that we looked at, because we had heard or we understood from our outreach and research that there was significant cost for them to value those, even though it was like a one-time thing. And so that was part of the alternative to help ease the cost burden. Back at the time, though, when we had the same dialogue with public companies, and I think we've since refreshed some of that analysis, they didn't have the same cost burden. They were able to do valuations internally. They were able to do other things to ease the cost burden. So it was a little bit of a different equation. So very naturally, I think, when we were thinking about whether we extend some of those proposals, those alternatives to public companies, we would have swept that in.
Christine?
So the subsuming of those, though, in the private company exception is dependent on amortization. So the idea is not to subsume these things that may not be assets into goodwill and just end up with a bigger chunk that's sitting there. You know, if you go back and look at the some of the history around the decision to stop amortizing goodwill, it wasn't a conceptual argument at the time. The FASB wanted to get rid of pooling of interest accounting, and that was going to create a whole bunch of goodwill that companies didn't want to amortize because they didn't want the drag on their earnings. And so that's how we got to the impairment model. The original exposure draft proposed continuing amortization of goodwill, and it wasn't until the hue and cry came up from preparers about that amortization model that the board decided to go with an impairment model at that time. Now, the other concern then was that there was just going to be this chunk sitting on the balance sheet that wasn't going to get amortized anymore. Now, let's try to make that chunk as small as possible. So let's start thinking up things that we can identify as assets and pull them out. So all of this is related to some political horse trading that went on many, many years ago. And
you
came
to these conclusions purely on conceptual grounds.
No. And so what's happened is... So what's happened is that we came up with some conceptual, and I'll put that in air quotes, arguments to justify what was done, and then the market and everybody has drunk that Kool-Aid. And now we're trying to continue with a model that simply was created at the time because for practical reasons we wanted to get rid of pooling of interest accounting. And that was a good decision.
Gary.
There's nothing new under the sun. Impairment was the model in the U.S. until 1969, when APB 17 came out. So these things just keep circling around. There's nothing. The arguments back then, it was actually before my time, but not by much. It was the same debate. Now there's more market cap and there's more goodwill or intangible value than there was in the 1950s and 60s. But the concept was still the same. There's nothing new in here. What was also forgotten back then, when you went to amortization, was amortization with impairment. Given a few years, you'd presumably get out of the impairment risk window. Mm-hmm. But I would say to both boards, and it's no secret I was in the minority vote on this, is the greater you can make the disclosures about post-acquisition performance on a timely basis, quarterly, semi-annually, annually, is the less and less need you need for an impairment model. If the idea was to communicate how is an acquisition doing, if you can do that well, then impairment, you don't need impairment. You can amortize it. To me, the issue on amortization, it's conceptually fine to amortize. The problem is you don't know how to measure it.
Measure impairment either.
But nothing lasts forever. Right.
It does go away. It was indefinite life, not infinite life.
That's right. So your issue was a measurement problem.
Yes.
Okay, before we go back to the 19th century, it's a good time to end this discussion. We thank the staff, and we hope for a divine intervention. We take a break till 4 o'clock.